is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. So, hello everyone. And nice to be here again, although this is a slightly different format from usual. I'm sure you are out there somewhere, even though I can only see a few of you. So it's very nice to be with you again. And there's always one of the marvelous things about being a monk is that you can always share the teachings of the Buddha with so many people. And it's such a privilege to be able to share these beautiful teachings with other people because they are so powerful. And I think there is nothing in the world that creates more happiness, at least potentially, if you practice in the right way, and reduces suffering more than these Buddhist teachings. But the hard thing is always to get these things to work, and sometimes people despair a little bit, they try to meditate, they try to practice this path, and sometimes there is a sense that maybe you're not making as much progress as you would like, and it's very important that we try to make that progress, because it is so encouraging when you feel that you're going somewhere, that you are changing your life, you're becoming a better person, you're becoming more pure-hearted, to use that word. It's so encouraging when you see change happening in your life. And this happens for the whole Buddhist path, but it also happens, of course, within meditation practice itself. It is so important that meditation is also felt to progress, at least over the long term, even if not from day to day, over the long term, we should ideally see some kind of progress. So I'm going to talk a little bit about meditation practice. And then we will try it out with maybe half an hour's meditation or something. And then afterwards, I can talk a little bit more and we can have some Q&A or whatever happens afterwards. Coming back to meditation again, and one of the things that we were talking about here during the rains retreat is the way Ajahn Brahm teaches meditation. Ajahn Brahm has this marvelous method of meditation whereby you just sit back and you just relax, and then everything happens from there. You don't do anything. You just allow things to happen. This is Ajahn Brahm's technique. Yeah? You don't do anything. No need to watch the breath or anything like that. You just relax, and then bang, you know, you get big lights and things kind of happen from there. Yeah? And it certainly, you know, when Ajahn Brahm talks about it, it's very persuasive, and you really can feel that he means it. This is actually how he practices himself. And he has very good results with that technique. Yeah? But one of the things that is interesting to me is that sometimes people complain. They say, oh, Ajahn Brahm teaches, just sit there, and then nothing happens. Yeah, I do exactly what he says. I just relax, and I don't do anything at all. And then I just, you know, I just fantasize about things, and I think about this, and I think about that. But it doesn't actually work. So it got me thinking, why is it that a technique which obviously works for Ajahn Brahm and for many people, it does work sometimes. Sometimes you just relax and things are really nice, but other times it doesn't happen. Why is that the case? What is it that is the difference here between someone like Ajahn Brahm and all these people who don't get the same results from the same technique? If we can understand that difference, then I think we can understand a lot about meditation practice, why it works, why it doesn't work, and all of that. So to start at the very beginning, usually when you follow Ajahn Brahm's technique, you just sit back and you just relax and you don't do anything at all. Even to get that part right is actually quite difficult. You try not to do anything and you end up trying not to do anything rather than not doing anything. And the trying part is the problem there. Trying not to do anything actually is a kind of doing. So it's important to have a perception, bring up a certain state of mind, a certain way of thinking about meditation that actually stops you from all that trying business. You actually want to really relax without the trying part. So how can you do that? And one of the ways that I like to think about that is that you imagine yourself, you are very tired, maybe after long day's work, and you come back home afterwards. If you come back home after a long day's work, what do you do? Well, if you have a bit of spare time, you might sit down. Yeah, you might sit down in your favorite armchair or something like that. And when you sit down in your favorite armchair and you feel really exhausted from a long day, what do you do when you sit down in that armchair? Do you try to relax? Do you force yourself to watch the breath? Do you kind of, you know, do? Basically, what happens when you come back after a long day's work is that you don't do anything at all. Yeah, when you sit down in your armchair, all you do is you just allow the world to flow through your head. You allow the thoughts to be exactly there. You don't do anything about it because that is exactly what you need when you are really exhausted from a long day. So this is, in a sense, the right way to think about meditation practice. It's similar to sitting down on an armchair or a sofa or whatever and just relaxing and not doing anything at all. Yeah, and that is really what it means not to do anything. Yeah? Allowing things to flow, allowing your mind to go, allowing the sounds, whatever is there, to go through your mind and then carry on in that way. Yeah? And this is nice. Yeah, we all know how nice it is to really relax when we are exhausted. It's a very important thing that everyone should be doing. Yeah? But then there comes a point in that relaxation when the mind calms down a little bit, you regain a little bit of your energy. But then as soon as you start regaining your energy, you start to remember all the things you're supposed to do. Yeah, actually, I'm supposed to prepare dinner. I'm supposed to do this, I'm supposed to do that. Yeah, and then the mind reactivates again and you lose that beautiful calm state. And that is where the difference between some people and the way Ajahn Brahm teaches happen. Because Ajahn Brahm, he doesn't think about Well, he obviously doesn't think about what he's going to make for dinner. That's pretty obvious. But he doesn't think about anything at that point. He actually carries on with that peaceful mind, with that regained energy, and he uses that energy to take his mind to an even deeper level. Whereas many people, then actually the mind gets reactivated, and then you start thinking about the things that you're supposed to do and all of that. So why is it that Ajahn Brahm does not think? I'm using Ajahn Brahm as the example here because he's one of the great meditators of the world as far as I can see, and it's always useful to use him as the example. So why is it that Ajahn Brahm is able to remain peaceful while other people, they are not able to do that? What is the difference? And the difference, one of the main differences is the inclination of the mind. What is the mind actually interested in? What is it in the world that really absorbs us? What is it in the world that kind of where we think we should be going that leads to happiness for us and that does not lead to suffering of a certain kind? Yeah. And the reason the mind goes out to all the activities we're supposed to do, or it thinks about maybe some pleasure in life or whatever it is because we think that that is where we need to go to resolve things, to organize things. That is where we think the important things in life lie in that area. And because what is important in life, that's where the mind will go. It's always like that. The mind goes to what is important. The mind goes to that place. But for someone like Ajahn Brahm, it isn't like that. When Ajahn Brahm starts to become peaceful, he knows that there is nothing important to be done in the world. He knows that the world just carries on. There's ever more problems. You resolve one problem, another problem arises after it. You make one dinner, another dinner needs to be made soon afterwards. You finish your work assignment or whatever it is. You have that discussion that you need to have with your children or your partner or whatever it is. And there's another discussion coming up afterwards. And because you know that there is no end to that world, you know that that world, there is no final solution. Instead, you go to a place where there is more of a solution, and that is in the peace inside. So the idea here, the important thing here, is actually to have the inclination of the mind in the right place. The mind should incline towards understanding where real peace, where true happiness actually is to be discovered, to remember the limitations of the world, to remember that the world never stops. The world never comes to an end. It just carries on with more problems, more difficulties, again and again in the future. So what I would recommend you to do is always try to establish that sense of the importance of meditation practice, the realization where real happiness is to be found. Sometimes you can even bring up the idea of dying. Yeah, I really like the idea of dying. It freaks out some people, but I personally really like it. If it freaks you out, don't use it. Because dying and meditation are actually very closely related to each other. Why is that? Because when you die, you have to give everything up. Yeah, nothing in the world is really important anymore. Because nothing in the world is important anymore, you have to let it go. So the idea of dying is very closely related to the idea of meditation, because when we meditate, we want to let go in the same way as we do on our deathbed. It's a similar kind of thing. And you start to realize that the time from now until your deathbed, you're just going to carry on doing those same silly things that you have been doing for your whole life so far. There's no final resolution in that. So right now, instead of waiting till the moment you die, you bring that idea into the present moment, understanding where the happiness is. Just as you will understand that on your deathbed, you understand it now instead. You incline your mind towards peace. You incline your mind away from the world, to renouncing the world, because that world doesn't really have any real value. That world is always going to be problematic. That world is not going to give you what you want. We have all tried that already. Yeah, you know what it's like. Trying to find happiness in the world, trying to satisfy our cravings, trying to find the perfect relationships. And there is no such thing. And it just goes on and on and on. And there is no solution in that realm. So this is just a little bit of an idea of placing value into something that actually is worthy of being placed value into. And that is the meditation practice, the spiritual path, and withdrawing the interest from the world, those worldly things that will never give you what you are looking for really deep down. So sometimes a little bit of reflection can be very useful on this path. And sometimes this is called vipassana practice or insight or clear seeing, because it clarifies the mind and it kind of Using reflection as a tool to guide the mind in the right place, in the right thing here. And then as you do that, then you can go back and just allowing your mind again to come to calm down, go back to that armchair, go back to that sofa where you just sit back and you allow things to be, you allow things to calm down. But now, hopefully, because your mind is inclining a little bit more in the right direction, then it will actually work this time rather than you being distracted too much. Of course, you will be distracted again because then something important comes up again and then you have to remind yourself again. Yeah, and this is kind of a sort of thing that goes on for a long, long, long time. But gradually, gradually, you start to move towards a more peaceful state of mind. So, there you are, just a little bit of introduction for you. I'm going to talk a little bit more about similar ideas maybe afterwards, after the meditation. But let's do some meditation together, first of all, and see what happens. Okay, everyone, so I hope you are all nicely, nice and comfortable, that you have a nice seat wherever you are. And always just start out by just checking your posture to make sure you are at ease, you don't have any pains or any problems. The meditation will last for about half an hour or so, so you should try to be comfortable for, you know, roughly that time period. And then it can be useful to, once you sit down and you find a sense of bodily comfort and ease, it can be useful to just draw a few deep breaths, just to allow any tension or whatever you might have, just to allow that to dissipate with the breath. A deep breath is always a nice way of allowing any residual tension or whatever is there, just to fade away. And now, if you wish, you can imagine yourself that you are coming back home after a long day and you feel quite tired. The mind has been trying to concentrate for a long time and it is so nice to come back home and be allowed to sit down. You have no business in front of you. There's no family members around you to draw your attention away. There's nothing happening at all. Apart from just being allowed to relax on that sofa or your armchair or whatever it is that you like to sit down. And you just sit there and you just relax and you don't do anything in the whole world. You just allow things to settle down gradually all by themselves. And whenever you get carried away a little bit, just remember that you are sitting in the sofa, just relaxing, not doing anything at all, because it is so important to get away from that usual idea of trying to do the meditation, rather than allowing the meditation to develop by itself. And the way to do that is to use some of these simple perceptions that bring you into the mind state, right mind state. All you're doing now is relaxing. You want to allow the mind to release its tiredness and all the problems that it's had for a long day. And now just let go of all of that and just enjoy the sitting there, allowing anything which wants to happen, allowing it to happen. One of the great benefits of just relaxing and not doing anything is that it is actually a very pleasurable thing to do. It is very easy to enjoy that. There's always a danger for people that they get sidetracked in meditation and they start to dislike it because of all the doing and the tightness in the mind and all of these negative side effects from meditation. So please don't go down that track. Instead, find the way of meditation which is pleasurable and enjoyable. And this allowing yourself to relax without doing anything is one of the great ways of doing that. So just notice that pleasure in doing this. Notice the sense of ease that comes with just relaxing like this. And as you do that, you will start to gain some insight into why we are doing this. And if you find yourself drifting off in the meditation, thinking about external and outside things, then try to bring up that perception of where the real meaning and happiness and end of suffering is to be found. You know that there is no meaning really in the ordinary things in life. There is some meaning there, but often not very profound. It's on a very superficial level. But the real meaning is to be found in the peace and the quiet inside. Not just meaning, but also a profound sense of happiness and joy arises within that stillness. Everything we want as human beings can be found in meditation practice. It's kind of paradoxical. Once you stop searching for this in the world, you find it within instead. So because of that, let go of that external world. There's nothing there really of interest. Now is the time to enjoy the spiritual happiness instead that comes from the inside. That is where real meaning, real purpose, and a real goal is to be found. And if you find that your mind is inclining towards peace, enjoying the peace. And sometimes it can be useful to watch the breath a little bit. The breath meditation is one of the favorite meditations of the Buddha, and it helps you to overcome the last thoughts of the mind which bother you. But only do it if already your mind is reasonably peaceful. Otherwise, just keep on trying to enjoy the peace and inclining the mind in the right direction. If you're going to watch the breath, allow yourself to come back on that sofa again where you're just relaxing. And when you're just relaxing after coming back from work, the way you see the breath is just naturally. The breath just happens to be there, and then you are aware of it as it happens to be there. In the same way, the breath meditation doesn't really need any willpower or anything like that. The breath already exists, and you just become aware of it and aware of its presence. And that is the ideal way of doing the breath meditation. Minimum willpower and just awareness of whatever is already there. Okay, everyone, so just coming towards the end now. And as we come towards the end, I would recommend you just to take a few moments to take stock and just to look at the progress and ask yourself how this process of meditation works. And as you review your meditation, you will start to understand the kind of perceptions, the way of looking at things, the views you have. What is it that actually works and what is it that does not work? And in this way you start to understand and take charge of your own meditation process. Okay, so that is it for now, the end of the meditation, so please come out. Okay, everyone, so there you are. So maybe if you wish, maybe we could, I don't know if you want to ask, anyone wants to ask any questions about meditation practice itself. Again, maybe start with that. But let's just start with some meditation questions, if you have any, and then any other questions we can maybe take towards the very end instead. So does anyone have anything in particular about meditation they would like to bring up, or any questions or comments or whatever it is? Or is everyone stunned into silence? Or
Ajahn Brahmani, just wanted to say how useful it was for me to have the reminder. Well, I'd never thought about it, meditation being like dying. And having done the death practice for, you know, as a regular practice for some time, I'm sort of thinking, oh, why did I think of that? Each time during the practice that I remembered that suggestion, that comment of yours that meditation was like dying, it supported a different orientation, a different mindset. It was really useful. So I really appreciated that as a reminder.
Excellent. Yeah, now, you know, once you start to understand what death really is about, then it starts to become obvious. And you sometimes these connections are very obvious, but we don't really think about things in the right way. And suddenly when you get that connection, you think, well, of course it is like that. And so, yeah, no, thank you for that comment. I'm glad you say that, because sometimes it shows you when you are ready for certain things, then it kind of things connect together naturally because you are ready to see it in that way. So marvelous. Yeah. Okay.
Ajahn Brahmani, I have another question.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
If you do a fairly regular meditation practice, but you have something really stressful come up in your life where you're very, very concerned for another family member, it becomes really difficult to focus on the meditation. Are there any techniques you can use when you're under quite extreme duress? To just try and still the mind. The normal sort of techniques don't seem to work when that happens.
Yeah. It is when anything kind of big happens in your life, you know, especially when it has to do with people in your life and family members, it is often very hard. And sometimes it's not going to work. So don't expect the meditation to work every time, because then you will just be disappointed. I think that's the first piece of advice. Also remember that the solution to problems and the way that you can help people is often if you are in the right state of mind. Yeah. So if you are peaceful, actually you have more power to help when you are in the right state than if you are, you know, scattered or thinking about things or not, you know, you don't have enough. Maybe, if you have a bit of compassion fatigue, you want to build the compassion back up again before it actually starts to bite. So remember that you are actually helping people by your meditation practice. And by thinking about it, very often you don't really help people because the thoughts just tend to go, you know what thinking is like, yeah? It goes around and around and around and doesn't really reach any conclusion very often. Your mind goes to a deeper level and suddenly you find that you see things that you never thought, actually, you couldn't see them before precisely because you are more peaceful and more at ease and you have a bit more metta and kindness in your heart as a consequence of that. So this is not always going to work. It may work only rarely, but it's, at least it's one way of thinking about it. So see if that helps. And you know, one of the other things that I think is very important if you're going through a difficult time or someone close to you are going through a difficult time, that is when you need more metta and compassion. Yeah, so you can do some of that metta meditation. It's a bit more active, so you can kind of you take that activity and you use it in a wholesome way rather than just allowing it to take over in a negative fashion. And you can even bring that person into it in that case, yeah? And then you can kind of bring them in and say, instead of thinking about them, just more actively wish them well and then see where that takes you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Okay. Everyone happy? Yeah? Everyone good? Yeah? Okay. Yeah, so if that's it, then I thought I would just talk a little bit and then we will see what happens and we can do some more. If it were towards the end you want to discuss some other topics, we can do that as well. It's really, really up to you. But I want to talk a little bit more about the ways of looking at the world which are helpful for the spiritual path and meditation practice. And there are many angles you can actually take on this. Yeah, I mean, the teachings of the Buddha are very quite vast. For those of you who have ever seen the Buddhist canon, it's said to have 84,000 suttas. I don't know if it's 84,000, but it's, you know, thousands of thousands anyway in there. Yeah. But one of the very important teachings of the Buddha is the idea of impermanence, called anicca in Pali. And I thought I would talk a little bit about the idea of impermanence and how it relates to daily life in particular and how it can be used in meditation practice. So one of the astonishing things about the idea of impermanence is that when you read the very last teaching of the Buddha, you know the very last teaching of the Buddha? The very last one is found just before he's about to pass away. Yeah? And the very last thing he says to his disciple before he kind of goes into meditation and then dies or passes away, or whatever you want to say, the Buddha, what happens to the Buddha. The very last thing he says is in Pali, it's called Vaya Dhamma Sankara Appamadena Sampadeta. And Vaya Dhamma Sankara means that all phenomena are of a nature to cease or come to an end. Yeah, all phenomena have the nature to come to an end. That is the last teaching of the Buddha. And of course, the idea of all phenomena having the nature to come to an end, that is a teaching about impermanence. Yeah, how everything comes to an end. That is what the Buddha says towards the very end. And sometimes you really, you know, sometimes you get so used to these teachings, you read them there and you think that, of course, he would say something like this. But it obviously, when the Buddha says this as his very last teaching, it means that it is something very special about it. Yeah, in a sense, you could argue that this teaching about impermanence, that all phenomena are subject to ending, is a summary of the entire teaching of the Buddha. All those 84,000 suttas, discourses, can be summarized in two words. Yeah. Vaya Dhamma Sankara. Why did the Buddha talk so much? If everything can be summarized in that. Well, to expand on that. Yeah, the rest is really commentary, if you like, on those, on that simple, single little line. Vaya Dhamma Sankara. Everything is of a nature to come to an end. So that is like a summary of the teaching of the Buddha, the doctrine, if you like, of Buddhism. And then Appamadena Sampadeta, the second part, means something like carry on, yeah, strive, not strive maybe, but succeed with heedfulness or something like that. Yeah, carry on with heedfulness, with carefulness, with care. In other words, practice. And that is a summary then of all the things that we have to do. So the first part is the summary of what the kind of the Buddhist outlook is like, everything is impermanent. And the second part is a summary of the path, strive on with heedfulness. That is the last teaching of the Buddha. And when you think about that, you start to realize how important this idea of impermanence is in Buddhism. Impermanence, anicca, can be thought of as things being unreliable. It can be thought of as things being out of control. Yeah, it often feels like we have a certain degree of control, but of course that is to a large extent an illusion. It can be thought of as I think actually unreliability and out of control are nice ways of thinking about the idea of impermanence. And then if you start to read the suttas, you see how the Buddha comes back to this idea again and again and again. It is one of the three characteristics that the Buddha talks about. The characteristics are the characteristics of all phenomena, and it's perhaps the most basic of those three characteristics in some ways. The other two is the characteristic of suffering, of dukkha, or unsatisfactoriness, if you like. And the third one is the characteristic of non-self, anatta, in the Pali language. These are the three. And the most basic one of those is probably anicca. So why is this so important? Why does it matter so much? One thing is that one very basic reason why it matters so much is because it is quite easy to relate to. Yeah, we all know about impermanence to some extent. We have some idea of what it means or how it applies in our life. It is fairly obvious, and I'm going to talk a bit more about that in a second. So it is fairly easy to relate to the idea of impermanence. This is one reason why the Buddha talks about it. And the second reason is that it is also very closely related to the idea of suffering. Yeah, it's quite obvious that when things are impermanent, then suffering is just behind it. And if you think about the first noble truth of the Buddha, the first noble truth is about, birth is suffering, illness is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering. Yeah, and these things, and especially death, which is a very big thing in the Buddhist teachings, is all about impermanence. Yeah, impermanence is a very important part of death, and that is why it is so problematic, because you have to give up so much. You don't really know where you're going. It is kind of impermanence in the very, all the impermanence kind of collected into one moment, the moment you die. Yeah, everything has to go pretty much. There's very little that you take with you at that moment. And that is why death is so frightening for most people, yeah, depending on how developed your mind is. So idea of suffering and the idea of impermanence are very closely related to each other. If you understand one, you understand the other. People generally in the world don't like impermanence. It challenges them in a very deep way. So if you read the word of the Buddha, you find this idea across the board. It is so, so common in the suttas, and it's a fundamental idea, and it's very useful to reflect on this. And I would really recommend you to reflect on this idea quite a lot, because it inclines your mind precisely towards spiritual life and away from the ordinary life. Now, one of the ways that sometimes I read a bit of news and I see what's happening in the world, and sometimes you see one of the kind of the big news items recently has been all the protests around the world, the various kind of protests for various kind of causes, and we had the kind of the Me Too campaign going on for a long time and still going on. And then you had the Black Lives Matter thing in the US, not only in the US, but it tends to carry on into the rest of the world and when it starts in the US. I think when all of this, and I like to comment sometimes a little bit on contemporary things, because I think it's nice to tie these things into the Buddhist teachings, because it gives us the tools to understand these issues from a Buddhist point of view, which I think can be very, very useful. And I think a lot of these social movements where we try to rectify the injustices of the world, personally, I find them extremely important. I think it's so important that as societies, that we create fairer societies, that we give people a proper chance, that we don't have discrimination in our societies. And of course, it is almost impossible to have a society which is completely without discrimination. So there's always a job to be done there, always something more that we can do, something more that we can we can equalize things a bit more to give everybody a proper chance in the, in this life. And sometimes there are a lot of historical issues, yeah, things that go back in the past when society was even more unfair, and then we have to try to rectify some of those things from the past. And I think most fair-minded people in the world would agree that injustice and discrimination is generally bad for our society, not just bad for the people who are on the receiving end, but also bad even for other people who are not on the receiving end. It's bad for everybody, and society as a whole is diminished by these kind of things. So I'm very supportive of these things. I think they're very important. I think it's very useful that we try to move in that direction. But there is another side to this, which I thought I would bring out today. And one of the reasons I think that we see so many clashes over these things, yeah, even though we can maybe all agree that it is a good thing deep down, still we see all this polarization in society. We see one side being kind of seemingly opposed to this and the other side being very for. Why is it that we see so much opposition sometimes to these very worthwhile causes? What is the reason for that? And this, I think, comes back to the idea of impermanence. Yeah, people don't like change. Change is always very, very challenging. And when one group demands that they, you know, their rights, you know, I want to be heard more, I want to kind of, you know, boost our status in society or whatever it is, then another group is going to feel challenged by that. And this, why? Well, simply because it involves change. And any change in society or whatever sort it is always going to be regarded as a challenge. So I think it is important to understand that when one group makes, when we change anything in society, there's always going to be some resistance from other corners of society, simply because nobody really wants change. And this can become then very problematic. And I think it is important to us as a Buddhist, or really for anyone, to understand this, because when we understand the problem of change, we become more, we also start to see the broader picture in these things. We start to see more sides of the story, and we can start to be more effective even in actually how we cause the social change that we think are necessary in our society, because we understand the challenges for those people who are challenged by these very ideas. And then we can have a better conversation, we can have more empathy and compassion. I think it's terrible that we live in the world which is so, tends to be so polarized. Because when you live in a very polarized world, we tend to see the other side as non-humans. Yeah, they don't become humans anymore. They become this opponent which is blocking your access to the things you want, and everyone else is non-human. But really, the things that we have alike, that we have in common as human beings, are so much more important than the differences between us. All you have to do is look a little bit below the surface, a little bit below and behind our different political views or religious views. And what you see a heart, you see a mind, you see desires, you see fears that are almost exactly the same across all humans, regardless of background, gender, race, nationality, and all of the culture and all of these superficial things that seem to divide us. And then we can have more compassion for each other. And then we can start to change society in a better way by understanding the problems that are so common to all of us. And change is a challenge for people. And I think it's important that we remember that when we make demands that society should change in one way or another. So this is just an example of how to apply this in you know, on a kind of macro scale in society. And I just occurred to me recently that nobody was really, in my opinion, they weren't really analyzing the whole problem in the right way. And when you don't do that, you end up creating conflict rather than a common way of moving forward and resolving these issues. So that is one way of thinking about the idea of impermanence on the big scale. But of course, for most people, what is far more interesting is how we deal with it in our ordinary life. Yeah, and one of the ways of thinking about the idea of anicca and impermanence is to remember that it is often not as bad as it may seem. Yeah, sometimes it is strange how we fear change, we fear things to go the wrong way, and it's kind of natural for us. But actually, very often, these fears are often not really they don't really relate to any real problem out there, any real danger. So sometimes we just need to change our attitude and see the possibilities in things rather than see the danger in everything. There's one story which I have been telling. I was telling, I think, before the rains. I can't remember that, a long time ago. It seems like a long time ago anyway. It's not that far away. But this is just a book I was reading many years ago. I was still a student at university, and this seems like an eon ago now, as I was a student at university. It's my birthday coming up soon, and I'm getting really old now, which is it's good in some ways, but I guess in some ways it's not so good. Actually, being old is not so bad. I think it's just overblown, this idea of youth. I think, you know, being middle-aged or even moving towards old age is not such a bad thing, actually. Especially if you're a Buddhist monk, it's actually quite good. Anyway, so I read this book, and this was while I still had a girlfriend. It was a girlfriend who gave me this book, and so I read it. And in this book, there was a very interesting story. This was written by a man shortly after the Second World War. And he was talking about what he called the paradox of happiness in life. And of course, the Second World War was one of the most calamitous events in human history, especially in Europe. In Europe, it was extremely bad. Other parts of the world also extremely bad. Australia probably not so bad, but even Australia was obviously involved in some of these things. So it was a very terrifying moment for many people. You could see the build-up before the Second World War, how the Germans were gradually kind of gobbling up various countries around Europe, and people could see that something very big was about to happen. It would have been a very scary time. They had only just escaped from the First World War, which was a horror in Europe as well. And now it looked like they were heading for exactly the same thing again. So it was a very difficult time. And of course, the number of people who died was enormous, tens of millions of people who died in this thing. But the paradox, according to this author, and this was in Norway. Norway wasn't all that badly affected by the Second World War. The paradox was that he said that during the Second World War, many people felt more happiness than they had done beforehand. And it was weird. It was supposed to be the most disastrous thing that can happen to humanity. It was supposed to be the worst thing. And yet, there were certain things about that Second World War which drew out some very good qualities in the human beings in that society in Norway at that time. And what it led to, he said, it led to a sense of common purpose. Now there was a common enemy, the Nazis, and Nazism was there. It was a common enemy that we had to combat. There was a sense of common goal, a common purpose, people drawing together, a sense of camaraderie, a sense of friendship that wasn't there before, people giving up their self-interest for the greater good, becoming less selfish, looking at the larger things, being more compassionate, having more empathy, at least for their own kind, if not for the Germans. So they said there was actually a time when these spiritual qualities came to the fore in many people, where people were living a far more meaningful life in many ways than they had before the Second World War. So it is kind of, it's paradoxical. We think that this is a kind of change, a kind of problem. It's a sort of suffering that we really don't want to have. War is terrible, and war is terrible. It's obvious. But then it has this other side to it that you have never even thought about that actually is there. Other things come out of it that draw out qualities in human beings that actually make us better. And of course, the strange thing is that after the Second World War, the world has had one of the, there has been many countries anyway, especially in Europe, has been the longest time of peace for a very, very long time in Europe. And this is one of those very fascinating things, and again, a consequence of that. So change isn't always bad. Things don't always turn out as bad as we think they will when things change. Sometimes they even turn out for better. There's always a hidden side. There's often a silver lining in these things. And often that silver lining is pretty big. It's really wide, the silver lining. And the silver lining sometimes becomes bigger and more important than the actual problem itself, which is kind of fascinating. So this is one way to remind ourselves that actually change isn't always as dangerous as it seems to be. And then it can be less of a problem because of that. But still, change is still problematic. Yeah, and even though we can draw out the good things of it and we can kind of focus on the good side, it is still problematic for human beings. So the, another way of dealing with it, not just to remember that it's not as dangerous as it may seem, is to actually remind ourselves that this is the nature of the world. The world is inherently problematic. Yeah? And I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this topic now is precisely because now we are going through a time, I think, in world history that is very, very turbulent. And there are so many things happening around the world which are actually, you know, even in an objective sense, you have to be, it is quite concerning. Yeah, we don't know where the world is heading right now. There's so many things happening at the same time. And the COVID situation is only one of them. And that seems to be like the smallest one, maybe. Yeah, even though people are really concerned about that, that's probably the baby one of all the big problems that we have. Then you have the political situation around the world, which seems very volatile. And people are talking about things now that you haven't really heard people talk about for a long time, like war or civil war or kind of, you know, really big things being talked about in the public domain again, which obviously is concerning. And then you have things like the really big issues, like for many people, like climate change again. Where is the world going in terms of climate and these kind of things? There's lots of things kind of coming together. So it is a good time to remind ourselves and to think about the idea of impermanence and how to deal with this in a spiritual way here. And one of the things about the spiritual life, one of the beautiful things about it, is that we don't really rely on the future of the world for our happiness. The idea of impermanence is to always remember that the world has always been out of control. The world has always been problematic. What we are seeing now is just a reminder of what has always been there. Yeah, we have been through a very long time of peace after the Second World War. And after a while, you get complacent. You think that this is the way the world actually is. But no, the world really is problematic. It really, these things that we're seeing now are not necessarily aberrations from a rule of things, you know, always being peaceful or being right. This, in fact, is quite natural in a sense. You look at world history, you have been through this period many, many times before. So what that does, it reminds you that that world out there, we should not seek too much happiness in that world, because if we do, we're always going to be let down. It's always going to be problematic. And it is those people who seek happiness exclusively in that world, they are the ones who are going to be most concerned about what is happening for the future. But from a Buddhist point of view, is that if you want a good future, you'd have to live well. That is where, how a good future is created. Yeah? And for all those people who are good people and who live in a good way and who look after others, who care for others and do the right thing, and you have compassion for the world rather than allowing yourself to get too upset by the politics and all of those kind of things, that is how you create a good future. You don't create a good future by fixing the world, because there's absolutely no guarantee that the world is fixable. In fact, the more you look at it, the less fixable it appears and the more problematic it appears. So what this does, when you start to understand that the way to a happy future is actually in our inner life, your ability to create a happy future for yourself, but also for the world around you, lies within your power, because it is with how you live your life, how you relate to people around you, and how you relate to the world. That is where happiness is created. And when you think like that, when you understand the problems of the world, how the world will never actually deliver in the way we would like it to deliver, what it does is starts to turn your attention away from that world and towards the spiritual path instead, because you start to understand what really matters. So please don't waste this opportunity. Yeah, now we have the chance. Now we can really see how problematic the world actually is. It's becoming bleeding obvious. Yeah, it is really kind of, things are going really bad. And then you see that people like Ajahn Brahm, he's not affected at all. He's just the same Ajahn Brahm. He still tells exactly the same silly jokes as before. Nothing has changed, yeah? Why has nothing changed? Because from someone like Ajahn Brahm, happiness is to be found within. It is to be found in a completely different place than in the world outside. So don't waste this opportunity here. Don't forget, don't think that, oh, I hope things just come back to normal again soon. And then when things go back to normal, we forget about the lessons of the COVID, we forget the lessons about the politics being in turmoil, and then we kind of allow ourselves to be blinded by the reality of the world again. And we forget about these very important lessons that we can learn through periods of turmoil, that the world is inherently problematic. And if we want to find happiness anywhere, it has to be found in the spiritual practice. If you do that, it will lead you in the right direction. Being a spiritual person, maybe it sounds very highfalutin, yeah, that you have to go to some monastery far away in the Himalayas or something like that. But, being a spiritual person is how we live our everyday life. It is how you treat people from the time you get up in the morning, how you treat your family members, how you treat your work colleagues, how we deal with everyday life situations. That is where the spiritual life is really made. So if you can use an opportunity of turmoil, instead of grieving over it, instead of feeling the world is going to the dogs, actually if the world goes to the dogs, actually I'm okay with that. That is a really nice way of thinking about it. And then instead, you turn your mind around, turn it in a different direction, understanding the importance of the spiritual life, understanding the importance of caring for each other, being more compassionate because we're all in this problem together, and then building up your spiritual bank account that you really are creating real happiness for yourself in the future. Not a false sense of hope in the external world, but the real happiness that comes from within. And then you are on the right path and you're on the right track. Okay, so I'm going to stop there because I think that's enough. So it's just a little bit about the idea of impermanence and using a difficult situation to our benefit and advantage rather than grieving over the world and thinking that things are going downhill. Even if they are, often there's not that much you can do about it. Anyway, so would anyone like to comment or ask any questions or say anything or complain about my wrong view or anything here? Okay, thank you. That's good.
You're welcome,
yeah.
Anybody got any questions they'd like to ask Ajahn Bhumali while you've got the chance?
I don't have a question, but I have a comment, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Please, fire away.
Sherkar is in Canada, Ajahn Bhumali.
Okay, great, yeah. It's very strange with human beings, when things are going really well and moving along very smoothly, we sometimes we forget about the importance of the spiritual path, and we kind of, you know, we indulge in the world and we think everything is fine, and we think in some kind of deep sense at the back of our mind that we think that this is the way things should be and the way they will be, or they will get better, and we forget how fragile the situation often is and how easily things kind of get turned upside down again, you know. And so sometimes we need that wake-up call, and this is a very powerful wake-up call. And if we use the wake-up call in the right way, it actually is very beneficial. I think this is one of those very important lessons. So let's use this as a wake-up call, and let us remember that, yeah, and then carry on. And then right now we need people in the world who have a broader outlook, who are more spiritual, who are able to see things from many sides, who are able to see the humanity in people on the opposite side of politics, yeah, who don't see them as mad people or as lunatics or whatever, but see that we all are humans at the end of the day, and we all need, we all crave for understanding, for compassion, for support. And as you can do that, then you can really be a light, you can really be a beacon in a what seems like a very dark time in the world. And what a wonderful thing it is to be like that. So I appreciate your comment, and being in Toronto, you're much closer to all the action than we are in Australia. But the whole world is obviously affected by these things, because the United States is so powerful and so kind of, you know, it's on the news everywhere, that it actually affects the whole world. And so we all have a chance to learn from this. But thank you very much for your comment.
Ashok and Mali, we've just got someone in the chat box who doesn't have access to a microphone. Fiona just wants to say that she really enjoyed the meditation. Thank you, Ashok and Mali.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Anybody else with any questions? Just got 3 minutes left and then we're going to wrap up.
It's not a question, it's a comment. Do you remember when we first, our first meeting, I think, on Zoom, when you put a questionnaire out and we had a series of reactions to the current situation?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that, Rachel?
Okay.
No.
Sorry.
Yes.
That's right, and I said there was no box that I could really tick, so I put up happy, but I'm not really happy, and that wasn't the correct answer, but I was not indifferent either, but just to go with the flow, and I was in a better state of mind at that stage, because what I remember is that I didn't really have to please anybody or to do things to get through the day. My time was my own, and I could do with it what I wanted. And how you spend that, how you go about using that time was the important thing to me. Which is what Ajahn Brahmani was saying about bad things happening or changes happening, and you just sort of try to go with the flow. So I wasn't that deep where I was saying, oh, I'm growing spiritually like Ajahn Brahmani and the monks at Bodhinyana would be doing. I wasn't quite to that stage. I'm not still there.
Okay.
Any last comment from you, Ashok Brahmani?
Nice to see you all, and very nice to be here. And it's always nice to talk about Dhamma. So good luck, everyone, and enjoy the spiritual path.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good night, Ashok.
Good night. Good night.